Mr. President, distinguished head table guests, members of the Commonwealth Club of California, and our friends in the radio audience. Next Friday, from this rostrum, we shall present a matter of great controversy, a subject of wide and turbulent discussion in this Western business community. And today we shall refer to it only as the railroad merger. This local facsimile of the recent great debates will star in this corner the Vice President of the Southern Pacific, Ben F. Biagini, and in that corner, the President of the Western Pacific, Frederick B. Whitman. And I assure you that they are expected to come out fighting. Our guest today is one of America's foremost educators, a distinguished chemist, and a fine American citizen. He is Dr. James B. Conant, President Emeritus of Harvard University. Now, there is so much one can say about Dr. Conant. He is a former ambassador to the Federal Republic of Germany. At Harvard, he served as an assistant professor of chemistry, became an associate professor in 1925, then professor in 1927, a Sheldon Emery Professor of Organic Chemistry in 1929, and finally, chairman of the department in 1931, and then president of Harvard in 1933. He served as the United States High Commissioner for Germany in 1953 and was named ambassador to the Federal Republic of Germany in 1955. He is a former chairman of the National Defense Research Committee, a deputy director of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, and has held many, many other important assignments, both in and out of government. But above all, I think his major qualification is his ability to stand up and be counted when the going gets rough. He was one of the first to urge United States intervention in World War II. He spoke out for Lend-Lease. He backed the atomic bomb when it looked like a failure. He initiated a scholarship program at Harvard for qualified students, regardless of their financial status. In a definitive study of high schools, he publicly concluded that of the one-third of the high school graduates who usually go to four-year colleges, some would be better off in two-year colleges. He constantly is seeking ways and means to assist the top 15 to 20% of students he feels should go to a top four-year college. He believes that from this group must come our future leaders. It is this distinguished American educator that I introduce to you now. He speaks to us on the subject, A Glimpse Through the Iron Curtain, Dr. James B. Conant.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commonwealth Club of California, may I first of all express my appreciation the invitation to speak once again to this club at one of your luncheon meetings. It was many, many years ago that I first had this honor, and I want to take this occasion, if I may, to express my great pleasure at returning to San Francisco and Berkeley. It was very long time ago, in 1924, when Mrs. Conant and I first made the journey across the continent, where I had the opportunity of being an assistant professor of organic chemistry for a summer session over on the Berkeley campus. I may say that the telegram which invited me to come made it perfectly plain that I was only asked as a pinch hitter because the right man had suddenly got ill. But being both of us bred in the world New Englanders, this trip to the Bay District was, I assure you, a very great event in my education. And since I've had the opportunity of returning to San Francisco and Berkeley many times since, We always do so with great joy and enthusiasm. And I count it a great privilege that this month I have the honor of being a Regents Lecturer at the University of California and resident at the Berkeley campus under particularly the auspices of the Faculty of Engineering. Now, 1924, when we came here for the first time, was indeed a very long time ago. There are a few of you, only a few of you, who are old enough to remember back, I'm sure, to those days. But those of you who do will agree with me, I'm sure, when I say in retrospect that none of us in that period, period of the 20s, could have possibly imagined the kind of world in which we now live. Somebody had told me that summer of 1924, when I was enjoying the hospitality of Berkeley as it then was, that I would someday be speaking across the bay at San Francisco in a world in which was heavily divided by two totally opposed ideologies. The United States was threatened as a leader of a free world by a Sino-Soviet bloc, that in addition to living in a divided world, we were living in a world in which intercontinental rockets could deliver a method of destruction, involve the fusion of hydrogen, and that this destruction was such that one bomb could wipe out not only a whole city, but a large area of a country. And in addition to that, as a third unknown factor to us then, there would be emerging new nations with aggressive nationalism. The terrible issue of the difference of race and color would be by the forefront as it had never been before. Somebody had described the 1960s. To any of us that time, we would have said, oh, that's just an impossible, terrible, bad dream. Couldn't be possible for any number of reasons. Well, it is possible. It's the kind of world we live in, and as a man who well remembers the 1920s, I'm frank to say I don't like it. But it's a world we have to face. Now, I'm not proposing this afternoon to give you any solution to the terrible problems that face us as a nation and face our government. It's a consequence of these three factors which would have seemed so incredible to us in the 1920s. What I'm going to say is simply that I think that the American people should be better informed than they are about the realities which are involved in all three of these factors. A great deal is said about the devastating effect of the new weapons. Great deal is being said about the development of the new nations. To my mind, not enough is being said about the realities of communism, what it is really like in practice. And therefore, I'm going to take the few moments at my disposal to ask you, as it were, to have a look at what communism is really like in practice. Or perhaps I should rather say what the process of communizing a nation is really like in practice. For I think communizing a nation is something very different from what you will find, I'm told, and perhaps many of you have made the trip to Soviet Russia, where you will find communism has been in practice for more than a generation. The process of the changeover, so to speak, took place a long, long time ago. The process of communizing an undeveloped country without any basic literature or industry is still another problem about which I do not claim to have any information. But the process of trying to communize a highly literate, highly industrialized Western nation can be seen or glimpsed if you go to Berlin and, as it were, look through the Iron Curtain. And that's what I'm going to ask you to do with me for a few minutes here this afternoon. In the first place, may I remind you of the strange situation of the city of Berlin. I know some of you have visited it. This would be an old story to you. I must be refreshing your memory. You'll recall, by the accidents of history, Berlin is divided into the four sectors: American, the British, French, which are Free Berlin, the Soviet sector, which is administers part of the Soviet zone, which surrounds all of Berlin. You know the political and international problems which are a consequence of this location of the city. But you may not realize, if you haven't been to Berlin since the war, that if you, as you can, fly in from free Germany to free Berlin, that you can there find a place where, as I say, you can get a glimpse through the Iron Curtain and see what the process of communizing a nation is really like. You can, without much difficulty, take a trip into the Soviet sector of Berlin. You can go into the stores. You could try to talk with the inhabitants, but they're not very communicative, I assure you. You can go into the bookstores, and you will see very, very fine displays of the works of Marx, Lenin, those communist authors, and hardly any others. When I first went there, my first year or two in Germany as High Commissioner, which was 53, the works of Stalin were equally prominently displayed. But shortly thereafter, as you will recall, Stalin fell from favor. This was after his death and his denunciation. And it was interesting to note that the works of Stalin didn't disappear from those bookstores, but they went to the lower shelves. Nevertheless, it's interesting that his statue still remained there, and the great street which the Soviets are trying to build up in East Berlin, the Stalin Alley, still held his name. And when I went back to Berlin as a visitor about 18 months ago, I was curious to go back to the bookstores and see what had happened, and I was interested that Stalin's works, while not now as prominent as those of Marx and Lenin, had nevertheless come back to a fairly important place. So you can, just by wandering around the East sector, find out a good deal about communism, but you can find out a great deal more if you have an opportunity of reading the literature, the books in this bookstore, the pamphlets, and above all, one of the periodicals, a monthly periodical that's published by the Communist Party. Communist Party in Germany is called the Unity Party because they have forcefully combined the old Communist Party with the Social Democratic Party and the other parties which they pretend are still in existence. And this party publishes a journal called the Journal of Scientific Socialism. For those of you who read German, I recommend just pick up almost any number of that and read it through. Your head goes round, you are just dizzy, to wonder whether people can really mean the double talk that you find in such a journal. It is a kind of experience that I think all should have. It shows the difficulty of communicating with people who are thoroughly indoctrinated in the doctrines of the communist ideology. I will illustrate this strange use of words by simply a story which goes some time back. This was at the time of the Berlin Conference, which was in January 1954, you may recall. An attempt was made by the four occupying powers to come together in Berlin and get a settlement of the German problem and the Austrian problem as well, which was then still on the fire. And at this conference, of course, the United States was represented by our Foreign Secretary, Secretary of State, Mr. Dulles, French by Bidault, the English by Anthony Eden, and the Russians by Molotov. And early in the conference, I was there as High Ambassador, as one of the advisors, the American group, of course. We sat around a table, and early in the conference, Molotov made the demand that there be admitted to the conference table representatives of the government which they had set up in their Soviet zone of occupation. And, of course, he said, you can have this government and Bonn come to if you want. The meeting adjourned because of the time, and Mr. Dulles asked us what should he reply when it came his time the next day. And we suggested that he put on the record very clearly what this government was really like. We prepared a brief. So when it came his time to talk the next session, he said, this government, Mr. Molitor, that you asked to have represented, what kind of a government is it? This is the way it was elected. Then he gave the details of how at the so-called election a person was only given one ticket with one group of people who were to be elected to the people's chamber, and this had to be dropped into a ballot box or else, very publicly, man could ask for a pencil and go in a corner and mark something on the ballot right in the presence of the secret police. He said, of course, this is no kind of a government. We can't possibly let it into this conference meeting. When it came Molotov's turn to reply, I was worried, lest he say to Mr. Dulles, your facts are all wrong, which would have put me in an embarrassing situation. But to my amazement, when it came Molotov's turn, he said, why, of course, that's the way we carry out an election. It's the only way you can carry out an election and get a democratic government. If you carry out the elections the way you do in your part of Germany, in the so-called Federal Republic of Germany, what do you get? Nothing but imperialists, capitalists, ex-Nazis. This is the only way you can run a country. Well, this misuse of the word freedom and democracy, illustrated by just one more story. This is an article that appeared in this Journal of Scientific Socialism, published by the Communist Party in the Soviet zone of occupation, the so-called German Democratic Republic. This appeared just about the time of the Khrushchev Memorandum, which you will recall was more or less in the nature of a threat about our presence in Berlin. Of course, this delighted the writers of this article. They said that, of course, they ought to have all of Berlin, but they were willing to let the Western powers have something to say about their sector if arrangements could be made. But they said, of course, they have no rights anymore in Berlin at all. The Western powers have forfeited their rights. Has nothing to do with Potsdam, comes back to their behavior since the Yalta Agreement. Said it was agreed among the Russians, the British, and the Americans early in the war against the Nazis that they would undertake a joint task of making of Germany a democratic society, that they would undertake to democratize this nation. The occupying powers of the West have completely failed. Only in our zone of occupation have we succeeded in establishing a true democracy. Well, this is the kind of words you meet if you deal with the communist literature, or if you try to argue, for that matter, with the proponents of the regime. There are many interesting things you can see and learn in this city of Berlin, this free city. Sometimes we call it Citadel of Freedom. I think the most interesting, though, is provided by the experience of the refugees. The ordinary person, I admit, wouldn't have this opportunity, but as High Commissioner and later Ambassador, I was allowed to participate, to listen in at the cross-examination of the refugees who daily stream across the frontier, separating one kind of Berlin from the other. I think you're all aware of the fact that the existence of Berlin provides, as it were, an escape hatch for those within the Soviet zone of occupation who just can't take this process of being communized any longer. The reason, of course, is that Berlin itself, we still have the theory that within the four sectors there must be free circulation, and the subway still runs, connecting the Soviet sector with the free sectors, the American, the British, and the French. So all that a dissatisfied East German has to do is to sign some excuse of getting to Soviet sector, which is essentially the capital of the Soviet zone. They could hardly exclude a man from the capital of the country, which they're claiming is the democracy of the world. Then once there, on some excuse, he takes the subway, gets out, subway station, American sector, announces himself to the police, who directs him to the refugee center, and there he's taken care of, cross-questioned, and when he has established that he's a bona fide refugee, he's flown out to a job in the Federal Republic of Germany. Well, now, these cross-questioning of these people bring out more clearly than anything else what the process, as I say, of communization is really like. You hear all sorts of things, but to my mind, the most revealing, the most terrible in a way, is the evidence that they present of the consequences of living in a police state which is still struggling to put its doctrine across. They must be required, so they said, to be ready to spy on their friends and their relatives, to take jobs solely for the position of being able to inform against their friends and their relatives as to what they might say or what their actions would be. This degradation, as it were, of the spirit of freedom and of individual liberty, to my mind, is the most shocking aspect of what one hears about life in the Soviet zone. Of course, there are many, many other faces that are brought out by their testimony, or can be brought out for that matter by reading the reports in the papers, either those published from Berlin on the free side, or for that matter reading right in what is printed by this unfree press in the Soviet zone itself. Beginnings of a progressive nationalization of even the smallest stores and industries. The now practically complete collectivization of the farms, the monolithic organization of instruction, complete remaking of the old German system of education, and interestingly enough, the basis for it isn't any action taken by this falsely elected People's Chamber, but is frankly said to be a directive of the party or a decision of the executive committee. It would be interesting to take too long to describe how the universities have been transformed and their schools as well to fit with the whole communist ideology. Suffice it to say that the old University of Berlin, which by accident was in the Soviet sector, has become a completely communized university. Students there are required, whatever may be their specialty, to devote a certain amount of time to the study of the works of Marx and Lenin. In other words, to continue their communist indoctrination. The struggle for the control of the professors in that university and the other old famous universities throughout the Soviet zone is of particular interest to those of us in the academic world. It's been a slow process. Professors have resisted, and then most of them, when they can't take it any longer, find some excuse for coming to Berlin, take the subway, and are in freedom. Most famous case was about 3 years ago, when the communists in the Soviet zone were planning a great celebration about the foundation of the famous University of Jena. I think it was 500 years, I'm not sure of the exact number, which was going to be celebrated. They were going to put on a great show and many speeches, and the rector of the university was to play the leading part. About a week before the celebration, he came to Berlin on some excuse, took the subway, appeared in the American zone, and was willing to have a press conference. And what he said about education in the Soviet zone and about the developments in his own university was not at all what the occupying forces of the Russians or their communist puppet regime wanted to hear. This fiasco obviously underlined to them and to the free world what's going on in the attempts to shape and mold the thoughts of the professors and the students throughout their educational system. I could take time to tell you many stories about illustrating the process which has been going on. I think it is difficult to have an estimate as to their present success. There's been a great, great controversy between the church, which is largely Protestant, as you know, in that part of Germany, and the Communist Party, a great struggle for the mind of youth. I think on the whole, the church has lost to the extent that they've been having to admit that the youth can accept membership in the party, and they still will be allowed within the fold of the church, although at one time they tried to make an issue there. On the other hand, the observers of the facts of within the Soviet zone report, in their opinion still, that if there could be free elections tomorrow or the next day, that not more than 15% of the voters would register their approval of the Soviet system, the communists who are in control. Probably a very much smaller group, a hardcore of German communists, backed, of course, by Russian troops, bayonets and tanks, actually control this government, this puppet regime in this part of Germany. Another group, a very large group, after all, must conform. They are the civil servants. They carry on. But I think it can be said that up to date, in spite of 16 years of heavy indoctrination, pressures of all sorts, including arbitrary arrests, long sentences for all sorts of minor offenses, and the obvious desire of many refugees to leave, that in spite of all this, I think it can be said that the Soviets are still struggling to communize this part of Germany. Why do they want to do it? Well, to my mind, the answer is quite simple. They want to have a firm forward position for their doctrines and for their beliefs in the inevitability of their system. If they could, which they haven't yet succeeded, in winning over to the real allegiance to their point of view, a majority of these 17 million Germans who live in the Soviet zone of occupation, they would have made a great step forward for their cause. The existence of Free Berlin, to my mind, is one of the reasons that they haven't succeeded any more than they have as yet. The very existence of the free sectors of Berlin, with the free newspapers, its radio, the opportunity to show what the free world is really like, been a tremendous demonstration to the inhabitants of the Soviet zone of Germany. Furthermore, of course, the ability to leave through this escape hatch if things get too tough. It's been another reason why communism has not been accepted in the Soviet zone of occupation with the thought, it's inevitable, we have nothing to do but to succumb. Now, it seems to me that the facts that I've been printing here briefly this afternoon are facts that should be better known among the people of the United States. Admittedly, it's not a pretty picture. This is a grim story that I've been relating. Yet I think every detail is worth observing. What the refugees have to say about espionage, about the police system, about the arbitrary arrests and long imprisonments, about the writings in the journals, the attitude of the professors who've been indoctrinated, the whole remaking of an educational system into a monolithic one, the way in which every aspect of the culture must be fitted into the communist pattern. These are the things I think we ought to know about. For example, the Minister of Culture in the so-called German Democratic Republic not long ago made this statement, apropos of either art or music, literature, history, what have you. The right is what is right for the party, and what is not right for the party is wrong. These are the criteria that are laid down for the whole pattern of life in the Soviet zone of occupation. This is what the communization or the attempted communization of a highly literate, highly industrialized people is really like. I suggest that this kind of evidence, revolting as it is, needs to be considered with the utmost care by the American people in this period of our history. And for this opportunity, presenting briefly this evidence to you, to this group this afternoon, please accept my heartiest thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Cornett. And now I present to this audience the president of the Commonwealth Club of California to moderate a question and answer period, Lloyd E. Grabeel.
Dr. Conant, as you return to the center here of the lectern to answer the questions, if you will, when you've had that little sip of coffee, Dr. Conant, I want you to know, as laboring under a voice difficulty, and said, keep the cold water here and the hot coffee here in case I need either, and he didn't need either. This question is a transitional question, Dr. Conant. If you'll return here, sort of a seventh-inning question. Aren't you lucky not to be president of Harvard when the faculty has gone to Washington?
I don't know. That cuts a lot of ways. I don't think I have to answer that one. I think your laughter, and I'm sure the applause of some people, if you would answer it for me.
And now into the meat of your talk, some questions of information. are property rights of American citizens recognized by the Soviet zone of Germany?
Well, interestingly enough, I never heard that raised before. I can't imagine they are, since the property rights of the Germans aren't recognized either. Of course, all this collectivization, but I can't imagine that there's been any talk about compensation for property taken over. So without looking up the facts, my guess would be the answer would be a firm no.
Now, very, very basic question. There are two or three questions that bear on this point. Can we ever pull out of Berlin and leave that city to communism? And short of war, can we realistically look forward to a solution of a divided Berlin and Germany, which would be favorable to the Western powers and the free world? If so, how could this solution be reached?
Oh, my. Well, one would need a crystal ball to get the answer to that one, all right, from the point of view of being a prophet. One can only express one's hopes and beliefs. I'm firmly of the opinion that the repeated statements made by the President of the United States in the last administration and this administration, and repeated only a few days ago by our Secretary of State, Dean Rusker, I only hope those will continue, as I believe they will be, to continue to be the firm policy of the United States government and to represent the opinion of the vast majority inhabitants of this country. Attempt to rephrase what was said, but it amounts to the fact of a repeated declaration that we will not abandon Berlin. We will not turn it over to the communists. That we insist on the continuation of the present situation until such a time as there can be negotiated a solution of the total German problem. This has been our position now ever since the end of the blockade. I think it is of the greatest importance that we hold to that bold position. Now, as to the prophecy of when it would be possible to negotiate with the Soviet Union a settlement of the divided Germany, I can make no prophecy. There was a time, at the time of the conference in 1954, when perhaps some of us and some of the West Germans had some hope that the Russians might be willing to consider a solution along the lines of our old formula, which was a free election of a government in the Soviet zone, and then an election of a totally new government for all of Germany. For what we've sometimes forgotten is that the government in Bonn, the government of the Federal Republic of Germany, is by its own statement a temporary government, and therefore says that it has no mandate to negotiate a peace treaty covering all of what was once Germany. Someday, one hopes, it may be possible to establish a free all-German government. But I'm frank to say I see no prospects of such a solution anywhere in the foreseeable future.
Now, Dr. Conant, another question of information. There has been considerable written about the number of people leaving the Soviet zone for West Berlin. This question is asked, can you give us some information as to how many people leave West Berlin for the Soviet sector? These, in other words, the people who wish to embrace communism.
I think there are relatively few who actually have grown up in either the Federal Republic of Germany or West Berlin and then moved freely over to the Soviet zone. There must have been a good many at the time of the blockade who made their decision as to whether they would stay in one side or the other. And I imagine all the hardcore communists, or most of them at that time, decided to throw in their fate with what they may well have thought was the wave of the future, namely the acceptance of communism in Germany, which was being accepted in their Soviet zone of occupation. And it wasn't at all clear the West powers were going to stand firm on the Berlin blockade. So at that time, there may have been a movement of that type of person. Since then, I think all the people have moved from west to east have been dissatisfied people who originally left the Soviet zone and came over. And it's hard to get the figures. It's not a large percentage from all one can hear. I don't know of the 2.5 million refugees who've left the Soviet zone of occupation since 1946, certainly not more than the small percent have returned to their former place of residence. Those who have returned, so we understand, are people who are pretty well indoctrinated already with the ideas of the Soviet occupying forces or the now communist regime, and who found that the situation in the West was not what they had expected. And this coupled, frankly, with the straight economic motive that some of them expected to suddenly come into a land flowing with milk and honey and wonderful jobs and so on, this disillusionment on a personal basis is surely another factor. But the vast, vast majority of those who left the zone for the kind of reasons I've mentioned, simply they couldn't take it any longer in a police state. These people have stayed in their part of freedom, either West Berlin or, for the most part, the Federal Republic of Germany, to which you understand they're flown out by the federal government and distributed among the several states of the Federal Republic of Germany.
I think this next question might logically follow your answer. Do you feel that the Federal Republic of Germany is a reliable stopper for the defense of the free world? In other words, a reliable partner in NATO?
Yes, I feel it is very much, and I'm glad the question has been raised because I know that there are some Americans who I think are not properly informed about the developments in the Federal Republic of Germany, who seem to be worried about two facts. One, that Germany, of course, now is being rearmed or is rearming itself under great prodding, I may say, from the United States originally to do so, of course, and is now developing a powerful military force, which is one of the important ingredients of the all-too-small force, which is part of NATO to protects the whole free world along the line, separates slavery from freedom along the continent of Europe. The other one is that there have been stories, and I think gross misdistortions, of the alleged influence of ex-Nazis on the present government of Germany. And I raise this issue here because I've heard it raised a number of times by people whom I say I think have been misinformed or misunderstood. I am convinced myself that except for a very small group of diehards, that the Nazi movement is essentially dead and buried in Germany. And I commit myself to the prophecy, and those of you who live long enough will see whether I'm right or not, that there will not be another right radical movement of any significance in the Federal Republic of Germany, provided we continue to have a moderately prosperous free world. Come another Great Depression, another great wave of unemployment in Europe, then I, for one, would put no bets on the continuation of freedom democracy either in Germany or in any other country of Europe, for that matter. But barring that and a global war, I would say there would not be a significant right radical movement. Secondly, even the movement that might start as a protest, I do not believe would accept the slogans or the objectives or the tokens of the old Nazi party. I believe these have been thoroughly discredited. The few people with a Nazi past who have been associated one way or another with the present regime, I think their records can be easily explained, and I always answer is, Chancellor Adenauer was imprisoned 3 times by the Nazis. It's a miracle that he wasn't executed at the time of the great reprisal that Hitler made on all the people who were opposed to him in the time of the unsuccessful bomb attack. And I would think that Chancellor Adenauer was a better judge of who was a real Nazi than anybody else. And therefore, I take his judgment that the people that he asks in his government are thoroughly committed to his point of view, which is ours.
We have a question which I suppose means some limitation of time in the answer. Please tell us about the new university in Berlin. As a former university president, you may want to dwell on the subject longer than our time allows.
I think I can sum it up in a minute or two. Maybe an old story to some of you. If it isn't, this story is worth repeating. At the time of the blockade, when nobody could see what the future was going to be, whether we're going to stand firm and win this battle or not, a group of students and professors in the old Berlin University, which, as I say, is located by accident in the Soviet sector, came to General Clay, so I'm told, and to the then mayor, or acting mayor of Berlin, Ernst Reuter, said the Soviet group are Sovietizing, communizing University of Berlin so rapidly that it will soon cease to be a university in any real sense of the word. We want to migrate into the American zone and establish a new, free university. And although these are the times of flying in fuel and coal, fuel and food, Clay and Reuter agreed they made available for this group of refugees a few buildings in Dahlem, the old Kaiser Wilhelm Institute buildings, and there was thus established a totally new Free University of Berlin. It has prospered. It's now one of the important big universities in free Germany, thanks in part to American taxpayers' money that was put in through the occupation, and part to money put in by the Federal Republic of Germany and some very generous and important grants made by the Ford Foundation. This university now stands not only as a symbol of freedom, but is a contrast to this other university, which has been renamed by the Soviets, the Humboldt University, which is down the, across the border, so to speak, a border which separates Free Berlin from the Soviet sector. One could have an interesting time, if it were possible, to interview on successive days the students in these two universities. It would be easy to talk to those in the Free University, some of whom have been refugees from the other one. They'll tell you what being a student in an unfree university is like. It would be difficult, probably, for any Westerner or person from West Germany to get a real interview with the students of the old university, but the contrast would be well worth making.
Now, this next question, you may want to answer factually, although I'm not sure that you would have the information. To what extent is the distribution in Russia and East Germany of the magazine America equal to that in this country of the magazine USSR? You may want to comment. To what extent is the magazine America getting distribution?
I'm sorry, I'm afraid I haven't any information on that. After all, it is now 8 years. Now, 4 years since I left Germany and gone to far, and I'm therefore not in a position, I have no facts, I'm sorry to say, to answer that question.
The asking the question gives me a chance to do something we normally don't do up here, which I do once in a while. Would you find it possible to tell the audience that all kinds of material on Germany and the Soviet occupied zone is available at the German consulate in San Francisco? Two or three rather deep philosophical questions relating to this whole continuation of this ideological warfare. Can you foresee a world government with national sovereignty sacrificed without being forced by a thermonuclear war? Or, as better put, perhaps, in another phase, do you believe that communization is a transition phase applicable to societies that have lagged behind? Or is it, in your judgment, a process that will ultimately overreach the more presently progressive societies?
You really should supply a crystal ball to your speakers. I can see this. This is the art of prophecy I'm being asked to. In one case, one hates to be pessimistic, but I can't foresee a world government in the foreseeable future. It's a long subject to debate, and I'm acting here not as what I would like, but what I foresee. The communization, what is going to happen, of course, in Germany? About the other countries, you'd have to make the answer in each one. What's going to happen in Poland? What's going to happen in Hungary? What's going to be happening in some of the other countries where they're making great inroads, the so-called undeveloped one? You'd have to try to answer that group by group. State by state, almost. Far as Germany is concerned, if the Germans will continue to hold out the way they have, to be as resistant, it's conceivable. Now, I only say it's conceivable that the Russians may get tired of the whole process. This is considered by most people extreme optimism, I warn you. But I can imagine that the Russians might say at some time, well, perhaps, after all, we've got a bear by the tail there. It's an awful nuisance. Those Germans don't seem to take to our doctrine. This puppet regime is always telling us we've got to do things for them, put down a blockade and so on. It's conceivable to me that the time might come when they'd be willing to make some kind of a settlement, which would involve essentially a face-saving device by which they could give up their attempts to communize that part of Germany. I say this is conceivable, but I warn you that most people to whom I make this statement say, you are certainly an optimist.
Dr. Conant, we have had a succession, very fortunate succession, of college presidents. This question always comes up, and you have, I think, in our radio time, 60 seconds if you want to take it on. Do you feel it is necessary, and do you support or reject federal aid to teachers' salaries? Please summarize your views in reference to federal aid to public and private education.
I supported years ago the bill of Senator Taft's, which was for massive federal aid, which passed the Senate and was blocked in the House by the Rules Committee. That much on the record. The second, rather than argue the case, I recommend to all in this audience, particularly the business people, a document published by the Committee on Economic Development, which I happen to have the honor to be a member, which, as you know, is a group largely composed of business leaders. This organization had a subcommittee, of which I was a member, which published a pamphlet, which is the pamphlet I'm recommending, called Paying for Better Schools. You will find set forth there in hard-boiled analysis of the economic facts about American public education. And you will find a recommendation of a majority of the committee, which I was one, which was in favor of federal aid to those states who do not have the resources, by any reckoning, to do what they should do for their public schools. But you will also find dissenting opinions from some members of the committee who wouldn't go that far and others who thought it didn't go far enough. So you'll find in one volume a very succinct account of all three views which cover the spectrum of this highly controversial subject.
Dr. Conant, we are happy to have had you back here at the Forum of Commonwealth. The meeting is adjourned.
This is Stuart Richardson Ward, and across the microphone from me sits Dr. James B. Conant, former United States Ambassador to Germany, and also former President of Harvard University. Dr. Conant spoke before the weekly general meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California here at the Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco on his topic, A Glimpse Through the Iron Curtain, or Communism in the Soviet Zone of Germany. Dr. Conant, as Pope has told us, the proper study of mankind is man. And so you opened your talk today to the Commonwealth Club by analyzing some of the human material that is presently governing Eastern Germany.
Yes, that is correct. It was my thesis before the Commonwealth Club of California at noon today that it was important for the American people to understand what the process of communizing a nation was really like. I pointed out that to understand communism in practice, as well as know about it in theory, might be well to have a look at a highly literate, highly industrialized nation that was in process of being communized, or rather, a nation in which the Soviets were trying to communize it. This is something quite different from having a look at Soviet Union itself, where the process of communization took place a generation or more ago. But in the Soviet zone of occupation of Germany, we find that the Soviet authorities are still struggling through their puppet regime, the Communist Party, to communize this part of Germany.
Well, Dr. Conant, I'm reminded of the Southerner who was trying to hitch his mule, and his wife watched him from the window, arms akimbo, for a while, and the man wasn't getting anywhere. She finally raised the window. She says, Ebenezer, Ebenezer, where's your willpower? He says, woman, willpower's all right, but test this here mule's won't power. Is that about the situation in Eastern Germany?
Well, I should say there was a lot of resistance on the part of the Germans who live in the Soviet zone of occupation, some 17 million of them, to the process which the
Soviets and their agents, the Communist Party, are trying to carry on. One isn't sure as to just how far they've been successful, but people who know the most about the Soviet zone are inclined to think that if there were really free elections tomorrow in that part of Germany, that not more than 10 or 15% of the population at the most would vote for the communists and their doctrines.
Some years ago, Doctor, you may remember that General Romulo, later delegate to the United Nations in the Philippine Islands, wrote a book entitled Mother America, in which he referred to the Philippine Islands as being a window through which the people of Asia looked upon the United States. Would you say that perhaps Berlin, this division, which looks over to Eastern Berlin, is a window through which the free world looks out upon the Soviet world and vice versa?
Yes, exactly. One often says that the Iron Curtain is transparent. In Berlin, and that's why I've taken as the title for my remarks, which I gave this noon, A Glimpse Through the Iron Curtain. As you well know, the Berlin situation is an extraordinary one. Due to the accidents of history, you have a city deep in the Soviet zone of occupation, and a city which itself is divided between the three British, French, and American sectors, which are Free Berlin on the one hand, the Soviet sector, which is part of the Soviet zone for all practical purposes. So if you go to Free Berlin, as I know many of my listeners must have gone, they will have a chance to go over into the Soviet sector on a little inspection tour, and they can have a little look at what communized country, a process country in process of being communized, is really like. One of the things that would strike a visitor to the Soviet sector of Berlin would be, for example, the bookstores, in which one finds almost nothing except the classical works of the communist authors, Marx, Lenin, until the time when Stalin fell out of favor, so to speak, the works of Stalin too. One finds there extraordinary journals, pamphlets, and of course newspapers, which put forward the communist doctrine. And if one wants to realize in what way words can be misused, one has only to read this communist literature.
That bookstore side of thing seems to be all over. We find it even here in Mexico, in the principal cities of Mexico, and there seems to be a great quantity of that literature available. But you went on, Doctor, to talk about the people who come over to West Berlin, the free area, from the East Berlin, the Soviet area. How do they do that? How do they get across?
Yes, well, this is a very important point, and it's one of the reasons that Berlin is so significant for this whole struggle between the free world on the one hand and the Sino-Soviet bloc on the other. Because, in a sense, Berlin is sort of the escape hatch for those who live in the Soviet zone of occupation and who just can't take a police state any longer. Such a person, if he's willing to leave his goods and chattels behind and take a certain chance, will find some excuse for moving from wherever he lives in the Soviet zone, without anything except a parcel or two, to the Soviet sector. Since the Soviet sector of Berlin is, in theory, the capital of the Soviet zone, well, it's very difficult for anybody to object to such traveling. Once in the Soviet sector, however, if he watches his chance, he or she, he will take the subway, which still runs throughout Berlin, and take the subway train in the Soviet sector, but then get out at one of the stations in the American zone, and he's then in a zone of freedom. He'll probably then report to the police and ask for directions to get to the Center for Refugees, and there he'll be welcomed by other Germans who are in freedom, and he will be cross-examined eventually as to the reasons for his leaving. A test will be made to see if he's really a refugee. Now, in those processes of listening to what's told by these refugees, one finds out a great deal about what conditions are really like in a police state, which is endeavoring by all the methods it can to convert an unwilling population to the doctrines of communism.
And what do they say as to the all such matters as the collectivization of farms, of which we've heard so much, as to the changing of the school with the Pavlov doctrines of psychology they're now using and all the rest of it? How is it going? What's the report of these refugees?
Well, the reports of the refugees are, in the first place, that today, I'm told, the collectivization of the farms is almost complete. Their attempt to completely nationalize all the small stores and industries hasn't yet been completed. Reports differ as to how far they've gone. They give an account of their school and university system, which shows how the old university and school system of Germany has been turned into a monolithic structure. A lot of many interesting points about that that I could go into if I had time. But probably the most distressing part of the stories that one hears from these refugees is the extent to which inhabitants, the unfortunate inhabitants of the Soviet zone of Germany, are forced to spy on their friends and relatives. How many people are required to take jobs, which are jobs only that they may be in a position to report on the views and the attitudes of people who are supposed to be on friendly terms with them. This whole process of the espionage network of a police state is to me the most degrading, morally degrading aspect of the whole process of trying to communize a nation.
Would you say that that has a overall psychological effect on the people in regards to a lot of things?
I imagine it does. I imagine that people are very careful in the Soviet zone of Germany to whom they speak. I haven't tried myself, of course, because as High Commissioner and Pastor, I was hardly in a position to go to the Soviet sector and try to accost people on the street. But people I know who do that and who are well familiar will say that people are very cautious about what they say, and they look to the right and the left to see who's listening. Of course, in the old Nazi days under Hitler, all the Germans were subjected to this kind of terrorism. The remarkable analogy between all the terrible aspects of a totalitarian state under Hitler and under this communist domination of the Soviet zone is all too close, a close parallel indeed. The fight which the party is continually waging for the minds of the youth on the one hand and the intellectuals on the other, there are evidences of this on all sides.
Some people in this country have been greatly interested in the new psychology which the communists have been developing, which we understand to be a throwing out of Jung and Freud and all the behaviorists and all the rest, and putting in something based on Pavlovism, where the dog jumps when the light flashes, the bell rings. Do you see anything of that mass psychology or any success?
Well, I'm afraid I couldn't relate it to any particular theories of psychology, but if one reads the literature which is printed in the Soviet zone, for example, their journal, which is the Journal of Scientific Socialism, one finds such a distortion of all the cultural values, and all must be fitted into a framework of communist ideology, that one's head almost is dizzy with wondering if people believe what they write. For example, the Minister of Culture of the so-called German Democratic Republic, that's the puppet regime, you know, in the Soviet zone, once said that what is right only if the party says so. And if the party says something is wrong, it is therefore wrong.
I remember at Harvard campus, sir, before your day even was present, there as a little boy seeing the glass cases filled with snakes pickled in alcohol and the skeletons of everything from a bat up to a human being. You always taken an interest in that field. What did you find with respect to their teaching on anthropological matters, on the possibility of changing of the human mind? Was there anything of that in your observation?
Well, I couldn't give directly, but you can say if you look at the whole curriculum of their schools and what they're doing in the universities, that everything is determined first and last by, first, the decisions of the party congress. Second, that these decisions, they are alleged always to be in accord with the doctrines of dialectical materialism. For example, the students in the university, with the universities in the Soviet zone, you understand, the universities which aren't free, so students there must study every week certain amount of the classical literature of Soviet ideology, Marx, Lenin, and so on, dialectical materialism. This is a continuous process of indoctrination.
Would you say that art in general over there, painting and sculpture and so forth, is in a straitjacket, or does it have
a very much in a straitjacket? And again, the criteria always is this in the best interest of the party? Does this conform to what has been written by Marx or Lenin? It's an amazing twisting of cultural values. One could give many illustrations of this in regard to both what's written, what's performed in the opera, and so on.
You said, Doctor, that if there's more time that you could give us a little something on this monolithic approach to the educational system. We've got a minute. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, they have, by decree of the party, and this is interesting because they don't make hardly any pretense that this false facade of government which they have erected by elections which are far from free, that this really runs, because when they announce a change in their school system, they say it's the party Congress or the executive committee decreed we will do so-and-so. They've made over their whole school system in what they call polytechnic education. It was built in such a way that at every turn, the first and foremost concern is that the youth be made loyal members of the party, or rather than anything else. Secondly, that they then be made effective workers within a straitjacket of a totalitarian state, and therefore they are more or less fitted into one form or another.
Dr. James B. Conant, out here in our grapefruit and orange groves, we sometimes have a piece of fruit that is, as we call, a sport. It's a variation in spite of all the unification efforts. What happens to those human sports, those human people who refuse to go down the channels of the party line and wear a straitjacket?
Well, that's just where the difference between the Soviet zone of Germany comes in and the other countries, which are satellite countries, are trying to be being forced to be satellite. Because the man, if he dissents enough and just can't take it, he then becomes one of these refugees I spoke of. And we must remember that 2.5 million residents of the Soviet zone of occupation have left their homes and all behind and fled through Berlin to freedom.
Thank you very much, Dr. James B. Conant, former ambassador to Germany and former president of Harvard University. May I announce that next week, at the same time, the same station, I will be interviewing for you the Commonwealth Club of California speaker on that date, who will be the Southern Pacific Vice President, B.F. Biagini, and the Western Pacific President, Frederick B. Whitman, discussing the proposed Western Pacific merger. Stuart Richardson Ward, signing off.